This episode is brought to you by Rev1. Rev1's mission is to help entrepreneurs build great companies. As you navigate the waters of business entrepreneurship, you don't have to go it alone. A strategic partnership with Rev1 connects innovators to the talent, customers, space, and funding you need when you need it. Get started with Rev1 Startup Studio by visiting rev1ventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is rev1ventures.com. .com 614 Startups Nation, welcome to a special edition of the 614 Startups Podcast, broadcasting live from Cohatch, Dublin. And this special conversation is entitled Conversations with Venture, with my special guest, Brian Zucker. And this is probably,
Not the first person to mess it up.
Okay, it's all good. Proudly presented by the City of Dublin, Cohatch, and Loop. Now, I don't know if you guys have heard of Loop, but Loop is a return management company started and scaling right here in Columbus, Ohio, named one of the next billion-dollar startups for 2023 by Forbes. Loop is a startup to watch. Check them out at loopreturns.com for more info. All right, with that, join me in welcoming my guest, Brian Zucker, general partner of 1870 Ventures. Let's give him a round of applause. Second time's the charm, Brian.
Let's do it.
All right, welcome to the show, man. I like to start with a bit of background. Few people in the room know who you are, but the people who might be listening might not. So who is Brian?
Well, Dublin is definitely a part of my DNA. So I grew up here. I have been involved in a part of the city, essentially. It was actually a village when I moved here. Technically, we moved here in 1985, which meant we traveled across the river. Which was like 2 miles from our old house. And I will say this city has had a huge impact on my life, mainly not because the city had it, because my mom had it. And so a big part of my life has been watching somebody self-start, become a civil servant, care a lot about their community, and really understand that you can make a difference. Where you live, how you live, what you want to be like in your life. And so growing up here was great. I ended up playing lacrosse at Butler University, being the least athletic guy on the team and a D1 school, but I made it. Ultimately, got interested. I was obsessed. If anyone's over the age of 35, they might have noticed Jack Welch back in the day. And so Jack Welch was like probably a poor inspiration, but an inspiration for me to be interested in business when I was growing up. And ultimately, like, I ended up at GE, my first job. But I was reading business books, wanting to be a part of it. My parents didn't have money to give me, so I had to go make money somehow. So everything, you know, classic Midwest, like paperboy, landscape, mow lawns. I worked at Galleons, for anybody in Columbus who is old school enough. Commissioned sales back in the day. That was one of my most lucrative jobs pre-real life. But yeah, ultimately, I like to build stuff. I like to solve problems. I like to work with really smart people. And that's probably been the biggest thread of my career going forward. The big other shift for me, just as a kind of a, I guess, to thread the needle to today, was I had a smart dean of the College of Business at Butler. I went to him after 5 years out in the real world and said, I need to make a change. I really want to be an entrepreneur. I really love technology. It was 2005 or whatever in Indianapolis, Indiana. Not a lot of tech startups going on. He's like, all right, you need to get out of town. You need to get it far out of town, actually. And suggested to go to RPI for grad school. And I got paired up with a PhD first day of school, spent 2 years building a company, learning about venture finance, about tech commercialization. And it really shaped a different point of view for me about how I could go on my own and the kind of the rest of that case. Moved back to Ohio in 2008. Which we can get into, but was a pretty pivotal time in the community to be at an intersection of growth for entrepreneurship, for technology. And so I was just lucky to be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, you know, that's a common thing with anybody who ends up being an entrepreneur is like, the bug bites you super early.
Yeah.
Right. And one of the things that was most valuable to me is an early commission only sales job.
Yeah.
There is nothing that tests your mettle or whether or not you truly want to be an entrepreneur than selling to live. And I sold in college paint jobs. Like we would go door to door and ask people if they wanted to get their house painted. Let's talk about the toughness, right? That those early kind of formative years or some of the early years just after you know, 2008, that really toughened you up and made you question whether or not entrepreneurship was really for you.
Yeah, I mean, the toughening up came long before that. You know, you sort of sink or swim as Jeremiah knows, you know, I'll tell a quick Dublin story. This is a good one. I was 17 when I graduated high school. I had a late birthday. I was out at 12:15 a.m. in Dublin, you know, post senior year with a couple friends. We luckily were not doing any serious damage at that point, but it was after midnight, which was past curfew, and we got pulled over by the Dublin police. And my mom was an elected official at the time. And, you know, so people who have been involved in families of elected officials understand that you represent your family in a slightly different way. So my friends were 18. I was not. It was a period of, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, where they were really cracking down on the tough criminals of post-midnight, you know, hoodlums. So they put me in the cop car. They called my parents. They didn't tell them what was going on, though. They just told them that the police had them and they were bringing me home. Now, I'm lucky that that was just the simple situation that it was. That being said, in the back of the cop car, I just said to the guy, like, hey, man, I'm just warning you. When you pull up, I'm the least of your concerns here. My mom is going to be extremely unhappy with me, but probably with you too. So let's just get ourselves together. He's like, I don't understand. I was like, just wait, buddy. And she let me have it, then let them have it. And, you know, that's just a token about toughness was, you know, she came out of the Depression, first generation American. Their parents were from the Depression age. Like, there's a bit of like, to pardon my French, don't fuck up your chance. Like, we got lucky. We were here. We're giving you a better shot at it. You have all these possibilities of achieving whatever you want in success. And so that was kind of the mentality was, you know, you have the keys to the car, like, don't screw it up. And also just, I mean, frankly, like the challenge is interesting. And if you can get a little bit of progress and you can taste that, then you want more of that. And so I'm not an intellectual giant. I'm not a professional athlete, but I aspire to be in those circles, even if I'm the worst one in the room. And so for me, it was like achievement was important. Achievement meant getting out of poverty, that's what it meant to my family historically. So, you know, that still was instilled there. To bring that back to 2008, where we're here, I think the grittiness and toughness of a community in characteristics of Columbus is that we are going to be overlooked by the folks outside of these, you know, like in New York or San Francisco in terms of technology entrepreneurship. So you are going to have to wear a separate hat in terms of maybe overcoming that. Now, I think that's improved, but the toughness, it's already hard to go make a choice to do something where you don't know what the outcome's gonna be. You're maybe putting financially things on the line, you're doing all this else. And then yes, you know, you could use the crutch of this isn't the place where this all happens as a thing. It just requires, you know, maybe a little more effort. And I think we're all proud of that. That's a big thing we wear, a chip on our shoulder. I like it. I don't want it to be easy. I mean, you know, frankly, that's what helps separate me from everyone else. I was able to work. I would outwork everybody else because I didn't have maybe like the skills that they had.
Yeah. So I'm a first generation American. So immigrant parents, we came from Liberia in 1992. And the presence of don't F it up.
Yeah.
Just hangs over you. Talk about representing your family and the pressures of that. So I certainly understand that. Now, you not only started building companies in Columbus early, but you were part of that early ecosystem building process with things like Wake Up Startup. For those of us who are kind of new to the startup game, what was it like back then?
Yeah, I mean, look, the first week, again, I'll just, there's some things that are just, you know, use your chances, right? So I was lucky. I came back to Columbus. I happened to come back when Startup Weekend, the first one ever in Columbus, was 2 or 3 weeks out from when I got back through my mom. You know, oh, he's into entrepreneurship. You know, I don't know that she knows what that means, but she sees the titles and the words next to everybody's name. So, and Tushar, who was here earlier, and I were talking about, she introduced me to a guy named Rick Copeland, who was part of the city of Dublin, helping out with Dublin Entrepreneur Center, who introduced me to somebody else, who introduced me to Startup Weekend. And, you know, at that time, it was just, it was very, I'll call it grassroots. Everybody that was getting involved was doing it really to help build the community they wanted to have, right? It was not taken for granted that there wasn't lots of meetups. There wasn't 614startups.com. There wasn't anybody paying attention to Columbus. So it was people like Rick. It was some of the communities like Dublin who are thinking ahead about how to be a catalyst for the community. Guys like Ben Blanquera and others who were willing to volunteer their time and their treasure to put together things. And for people who like startups, it was a startup. The community was a startup. And it was very addicting, and we all really like wanted this to grow this garden as fast as possible. And so honestly, it was, I look back as it was one of the most, I was just lucky to be a part of one of those fun early times when like the people that were in it were also starting companies. So like there was a true authenticity to their motivations. They needed talent, they needed co-founders, they needed capital. It was really grassroots at that stage. So it was a good time, but it was also frustrating too, because you maybe didn't have the resources you wanted to have.
And so, I mean, a lot has changed since then.
Yep.
You probably had a few stops along the way, but I want to spend the rest of the time talking about 1870s sure. Ventures, okay? So what is 1870 Ventures? And more specifically, what is your why behind launching sure. 1870.
Yeah, so 1870 Ventures is a deep tech venture studio. So we start, build, and scale companies within our firm. So one slight difference between us and maybe a traditional venture capital firm is that we are originating the ideas and the businesses inside our four walls. So we are deploying our capital within our own four walls on ideas, concepts, and businesses we want to build. We are particularly focused on businesses that we can back with intellectual property. So we have relationships with Ohio State and other big research institutions in the region to help identify the smartest people in the world that have been working on something for 30 years, where they have become the number one in their particular area of practice, and how do we help them scale that solution to help change the world for the better. So we're interested in areas like digital health and how we help affect patients' outcomes, better health for the world, and then also mobility, electrification, things about the environment, about our system, and just how we all live better and more healthy together.
So, you know, as a founder, I'm always thinking like, but why not come out here and invest in the companies that are already out here? Why the decision to bring everything in-house, the capital, the idea generation, and basically germinating these ideas yeah. and helping them grow? Why everything in-house?
It's a unique model, and it is a specific lane to fill. So many years ago, I wrote a little piece about entrepreneurial ecosystems that talked about the idea of a community garden as the entire ecosystem. And if you think about the garden participants, you have, you know, capital as fertilizers, you've got entrepreneurs trying to plant seeds, you've got university partners that are brewing up the new seeds, and you've got all this huge ecosystem that's going on. And if you look at the investment that happens in research and innovation, there is nothing even secondarily close to what happens in universities or research hospitals. Billions of dollars annually. And we live in a very lucky space at the Midwest, where we have land-grant universities at a scale unlike anything in the world. So we have some of the most incredible research and smart people here being worked on these things. Challenge is, they're dedicating their life to science, and they're maybe not interested or capable in leaving their jobs to start a company. So where we saw was an opportunity was this gap between identifying an opportunity, funding it. We talk about pre-seed. This is way pre-seed. This is in the lab sometimes. All the way through building that team, commercializing that. It is a long and kind of get your hands dirty process. And so this particular type of technology, deep tech, that requires a lot of shepherding and commercial concepting and investment, is why our firm focuses on that. Now, there are other ways for people in that space to do that. There are other avenues. If you're a scientist who wants to be able to become an entrepreneur on your own, you can still go a traditional entrepreneurship path. There's accelerators and there's venture and there's all that. We're really focused on how to solve these particular problems where we can be the leverage for that opportunity in-house. So, you know, think of us as, you know, growing the garden further, expanding even more now the entrepreneur definition of entrepreneur into PhD scientists who may not see themselves as an entrepreneur. So it's just a particularly, it's a model that's really specific to this. And the venture studio model has gained some traction across various different markets. But for us, that is why we do that. And so if you think about our co-founders, our scientists, our researchers, and people in those world versus, you know, people like me who were, you know, trying to solve my own problems in the shower, had an idea, and you know that's not the person that we were looking for. We're looking for the people that are way smarter than me.
Yeah. So I mean, that's a big bet.
Yeah.
Because you're working with personalities that I imagine are diametrically opposed to the entrepreneurship personality or what you would expect in entrepreneurship. How are you thinking about melding those personalities where the scientist co-founder, entrepreneur co-founder, what are you thinking about making that work? How do you make that work?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there is a, you know, I could challenge a little bit of the assumption that they don't want to do it. I think that they maybe either don't see themselves as it. You know, if I think about myself, like in 1998, coming out of high school in Columbus, Ohio, there wasn't a lot of people there was nobody that I knew, at least, talking about technology startups. But if you grew up in Silicon Valley, there was somebody talking about technology startups. So I think there's a generation of researchers who've watched the meta culture of entrepreneurship and understand the power of scale to their solutions, to their science, to their wealth creation for themselves. So the challenge for us is maybe less on the philosophical side of it, but more on the practical application side of it. And so what we have to do is, I think, demonstrate our value to them, that we are experts in helping understand the strategy and concept of building, bridging the gap between their science and the commercial application of their science. Oftentimes, we're coming up with a commercial problem to solve, and we're helping bring in their intellectual property into the solution versus the other way around. So it's a dance, it's a good dance. And I mean, I think you can find camaraderie in building solutions together. That's really the common thread, is seeing impact and progress. And then we bring them significantly financially into our companies. So I think there had been a history of tech transfer where it was, we're going to go get this IP and then we're going to go build a company, or we're going to sell this IP or license it, whatever. We want to work with them, invest in them and their lab, and grow that. That has not been something that's done in any kind of significant way ever. And so we're committed to that cause as a part of us.
So as you're having conversations with these scientific co-founders, or these researchers as your co-founders, have you started to think about intent? Like, I created this for, versus we see commercial application for this here. That's part of kind of that integrating them into the difference between, research that stays in the lab and then research that can actually have practical application. How are you thinking about that? Or are you getting any feedback from the universities or from the researchers saying, hey, that's not the intended purpose of why I did this?
Yeah, well, the art of persuasion here is evidence and data, which they all agree about, right? So their business is evidence and data and hypothesis and testing. So our job is to mirror that language, to meet that language with evidence and data to say, we believe we understand a commercial application for your technology, and we'd like to show you why. And so a huge amount of our effort and time inside the firm is developing those hypothesis test concepts, testing them, learning, and then being able to communicate that in a way that shows that we understand the best possible path to scale that to a solution. But yeah, it's still an art of persuasion. We will not win every battle there. There's a reason that people pick an academic track, and it doesn't always match up.
Support for the 614 Startups podcast comes from Nationwide. Nationwide's mission is to protect people, businesses, and futures with extraordinary care. To help fulfill that mission, Nationwide is looking to invest its $350 million venture capital investment fund in InsurTechs that will help them create new and exciting products and solutions to meet the needs of their customers. If you're interested in partnering with Nationwide's venture capital team, visit nationwideventures.com to learn more. Again, the website is nationwideventures.com. Nationwide is on your side.
Today's episode is sponsored by the City of Dublin's Division of Economic Development. The City of Dublin provides world-class tailored business services and resources to ensure the best possible environment for businesses to recruit talent and thrive. Because of this strategic focus and commitment to employer growth, Dublin is the only accredited economic development organization in the state of Ohio. The City of Dublin supports startups and entrepreneurs by offering targeted resources and training programs to grow companies that are financially sustainable, innovative, and committed to creating jobs. Learn how other businesses depend on Dublin. Visit thriveindublinohio.com. Yeah. Okay. So you, just like you have to sell it to the researchers, you have to sell it to your team. There are a couple of your team members in here, right? So you go out, you have this idea, you and your co-founders, but you got to go out and build a team. Let's talk about how you went about that process of deciding who are going to be the people who helped me take this thing from a dream to a reality and then eventually to a success.
Well, if you're talking about the firm specifically today, well, it's all about relationships. and timing of relationships is just serendipity to some extent. And, you know, I think in my case personally, you know, you're building a fictitious resume of experiences, and you hope they line up to something that you really care about at every chapter of your life that you're lucky to be. So I happen to be lucky that I have, you know, a partner, Joe, that is my cousin, who I've looked up to my whole life, who has been in finance, and he happens to, you know, have interest in this. And so we've tracked each other. But then, you know, Matt Armstead on our team, Matt and I have done all the things since, you know, 15 years, 20 years now that we've all been working on. And it's one of those situations where his path was going one way and mine was, we always had this almost intersection for 15 years where we could work on something together. And it just happened that, you know, his interest in his expertise building and studio and understanding team and early stage build intersected with that. So first and foremost, it was the serendipity and, you know, good karma of relationships. And having all done this now in startup land for a while, folks like Amy have been around for the ride. You have to find people with the scar tissue of early stage because they generate a particular understanding of changing fear into opportunity, right? And understanding that the world moves on and there is a practice to this thing. It's not the casino like everybody thinks it is, but there is a lot of unknown. And so the relationship, the trust, the idea of knowing that someone's going to work through the hard times with you, keep you along the way. I think that's a common DNA that we really looked for in our early team, was that who has been through the experience to survive the first downhill thing. There will be many. There will be uphill ones. You don't want to get too high on that, your own supply there. So that's the first thing. But you know, after that, then we started to have to develop the rigor now of how do we find the most talented people who align with our vision. Those are the most important factors for us. And admittedly, wasn't good at that. Found people that are good at that to help you put a process together to develop how to bring those team members on, because you know the relationship is great, and then you need to start to find the best talent. And so we're in that phase now of kind of getting out of our first concentric circle and starting to build, which is fun.
Yeah. Now, you know, the scar tissue part of it, like, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're going to get punched in the face. You're going to have ups and downs. And like you said, they're going to be lows and they're going to be highs, and you have to have equanimity. Your partner's on the university side. Your partner's on the research side. Do they understand that? Meaning, as they go into this, this is their baby. You told me there was a commercial application here. There's going to be that 9 out of 10, if that ratio holds, of, you know, companies that do well and companies that don't. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't expect anyone to stand in anyone else's shoes and absolutely feel the way that that person feels, but you hope that they're able to respect the process that you may have. And so I think it's on us to share our experiences, why they think they apply to whatever we're working on, and generate trust through experience. We should not be granted all of the trust up front. But I think what we're trying to focus on is we have a specific, very specific lane to fill. We're aligned in incentives. So if we can find alignment in incentives, then that helps bring all the rest of the things together. So these incentives are financial. These incentives are recruiting talent to their universities and places. That's growing our community. And then last and definitely not least important is having a positive impact on the world. And so, you know, it was important for us to have that as a core component to our mission, because we know that it aligns to the stated mission of most research institutions.
Okay, got it. All right, now you got me excited, man. I know I have to ask you a bunch of tough questions there, because I'm trying to get into the mind of both you, the university, and the researcher. But let's talk about the fun side of this. What are some ideas that you've seen or that you guys are working on, without giving away anything proprietary, that you're excited about?
Yeah, and I state up front, I am not a PhD. I am not experienced in all these areas, but what I can say is that what if you look at the history of the United States innovation and you look at moonshot concepts, literally moonshot in some cases, where the wake of those big goals spawned just huge, huge amount of innovation, you can look at the moonshot, the cancer moonshot we have, And when we look at the market and we see where federal funding and innovation meet together, there is unbelievable amount of potential. Add in all the other macro things happening with computation, AI, ML. Now it's really a question of like, how fast are we all going to bring these things to change our lives? And, you know, that's to be determined. So to get specific, digital health, which the way we define that is, you think about the fastest way to get the next cures of cancer, another thing is going to be on how do we discover cancer? How do we discover drugs? And data and patient data and things around that allow us to help discover that. So we really love the R&D side of pharma. And how do we capture real world data, the speed and incredible opportunity with AI and ML, and advancements in other types of devices and discovery all into one. And so we're interested in how to solve those problems. Within that, there are more problems than we'll ever figure out how to solve. But that'd be an area of really specific things that we care, biomarker discovery, biorepositories. Like, we love this idea of leveraging real world data. That transitions into other areas that we're interested in too, in technology. So if you think about physical assets that have the potential to have a data or a digital component to them, how do we convert those assets to digital components that have data? So part of the problem with mobility is going to be scaling the grid. And how do we understand how, the home and it's throwing off tons of, it's utilizing and throwing off tons of electricity and energy. We don't have, most of our stuff is not wired to connect to understand, both from the manufacturing and the car, the battery in between. So we're really excited about this idea of physical digital asset and the data component of real world data that can come out of that.
Yeah, so something very sci-fi. I mean, I don't know about you guys. I listen to NPR, okay? So I'm an NPR guy. And I heard about like them using CRISPR to do gene editing on bone marrow for people with sickle cell. So they like took their bone marrow, did gene editing on it, put it back inside of their bone marrow so it could produce healthy cells. Yeah. That's crazy, right? But so far the results are positive. Now, of course, we don't know long-term effects. And so again, you have to consider things like that. But one of the things that seems to accompany health innovation in particular is astronomical costs.
Sure.
Right? It's great that you can potentially heal or at least minimize the symptoms of sickle cell, but it's like $2 million. From an investor, also an entrepreneur, and just a human being, how are you thinking about some of the potentially life transformative innovations, right? Moonshots, like you said, could cure childhood diseases.
Yeah.
And cost. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, if there's, again, to just, I guess I have to keep coming back to my mom. If there's something that I learned about the United States uniquely, is that no one aspect of our society, government, private business, or NGO is going to solve that problem. It's a coordination problem. And so we have to develop ethics and morals that consider those aspects of drug development. And I'm familiar with a lot of the challenges in drug development around holding back drugs because the patent expiration. And so we're going to have to change the incentive structures. As a firm, you know, maybe our role is best served by vocalizing those issues while we're discovering opportunities and putting our hand up and going to the legislature and going to the community and making them aware that like, hey, there's opportunities, but they're going to be cost prohibitive, but it's opportunity to save lives. And so, I mean, that is a challenge in healthcare of our system is built on a massive coordination effort. And I think, luckily, I think the light, albeit small, is starting to be shown into how do we offer these solutions at scale while still rewarding the innovation of the private business to make money? Because that is, you know, all the flaws in capitalism, the reality is that it is an innovation engine. But yes, there is a challenge to figure out how to properly scale and provide wealth creation and do all that. I don't have the answer to that problem. But if I've watched anything and I learned anything, is we're sitting in a place that didn't even contemplate it being existence 20 years ago. my mom, amongst many other people, spent a decade researching what would provide a net benefit to the community. And with a massive coordination effort, private money, public money, made it happen. This place and this community isn't saving a life directly, but it should be inspiration that even at the local level, at a national level, if you have the right ethics and morals and incentives in place, you can build a coordinated effort to do things like scale life-saving things to other people.
Yeah, man, this is 614 Startups. We get philosophical on here too, okay? All right, so time to play profit, and then we're going to go to the audience if you have any questions for Brian. So if you could wave your magic wand, where do you see the Columbus and surrounding area kind of ecosystem over the next 10 years? What are we doing? What can we be doing to make that vision a reality?
Yeah, I come back to my garden metaphor. I mean, I think there's been so much effort spent on trying to create a great garden. We've often tried to compare our garden to Silicon Valley, to Austin, to wherever. I'm completely disinterested in those comparisons. We have to make a definition for what success looks like here. In my opinion, it's time to grow the garden. The garden needs growth across everything from the absolute small business sector up through, you know, drive-backed massive unicorn innovation. Because if there's something that I think can be a driver of wealth creation across all classes, all people, it's the ability to be self-governed and self-earning people. And I think Columbus is a unique place that we can do that. So I'm interested in seeing how we can all come together with a common goal around that growth of that garden. How do we include more? How do we build more? How do we support each other more? And I think that that's a challenge for leadership across the board at all organizations to be a part of that conversation, join that conversation. And I think much like our national politics sees that there is a time of a changing of the guard for generations to be leading. And one thing that I love about Columbus is that most people up till now are not from Columbus. And so this generation, and I'm probably at the very far end of the beginning of it, of like, was the first ones born in Columbus. Neither of my parents are from Columbus. And so Columbus in 1975 was a really small town. And so the people here who stay here were probably born in the region or area and want to be here. And so I'm excited to hear what the young people want this place to be and how they would define it. But the ecosystem's gonna grow. We need more capital. We need more venture studios. We need all kinds of new things adding to the market so that more people have more shots on goal, because it is a absolute numbers game. You need more capital, more entrepreneurs, all of that, no matter where it comes from, what scale, what size, lifestyle, business, blah, blah, blah. We just need more of it. And so I'm a proponent for getting as much of that on the table as possible.
This episode is brought to you by KJK. Tired of the billable hour? KJK has a solution. The KJK GC Advantage program offers businesses comprehensive legal services in the areas of employment, corporate services, real estate, trademark, intellectual property, and estate planning, all for a set monthly fee. KJK serves as their clients' partners in business, not just their lawyers. Along with cost certainty and predictability, the KJK GC Advantage program gives clients peace of mind, knowing their projects will be handled quickly and efficiently, maximizing the return on investment on their legal spend. So don't go it alone. Let KJK help. Learn more by visiting kjk.com.
I think a concept of, if I go raise money for my startup, let's say I'm going to put together a $2 million pre-seed fundraise for Brian's terrible idea. I will raise that money and then I will spend all of that money absolutely to the last cent, and then probably another 25% of it that I don't have, trying to make sure that that thing gives every chance it possibly has to succeed. There is a pretty high likelihood that somewhere in the first $250,000 of the $2 million that I might have figured out that the thing that I was doing didn't have any legs. And so there's still a lot of money on the table. Now, what we call that historically has been the pivot. But I mean, if we're being very honest, and many entrepreneurs would be, maybe often the pivot pivots so far away from the original thing that it's a new thing. I have a history of changing names of companies to show that pivot was as large as a pivot as possible. And sometimes it works, most times it doesn't, and it's not efficient for capital. So the studio model happens to just allow for us to incrementally invest in milestones that help us achieve the higher likelihood of success. So the capital efficiency is useful. We have a process of considering ideas. What I think is useful in the deep tech space is what you're referring to, Elio, is that there is a high amount of uncertainty as to whether or not there's efficacy in the solution. There could be regulatory hurdles. There could be many other things that apply. So a studio model for those purposes is useful to bifurcate those things early on and not waste capital on them when it's clear that they won't make it to market. The process is the rigor of sort of detaching yourself emotionally from the thing and focusing on the milestone that needs to be achieved to produce a higher probability of success.
Yeah, and can I add to that, Alex? You feel like he answered your question? Okay, no follow-up?
No.
Okay, so I'll follow up. One of the things that you mentioned is expertise, and the deep expertise that a scientist, a researcher brings to the problem that they're trying to solve. I'm not a media guy. I started a media company.
Yeah.
Chances of failing through the roof.
Yeah.
How do we as an ecosystem what's the value of expertise? Meaning, like, for somebody who aspires to be an entrepreneur, that deep knowledge in the industry that you're starting the business in, how can you talk to young founders about that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think on the spectrum of entrepreneurship, it really depends on what sector you're getting into. I mean, if you want to get into something that's a front-end consumer, like, your expertise might be in customer acquisition and marketing and branding, whereas, you know, you're talking about, cancer oncology clinical trial matching, you probably want Dave Billiter, who's one of our partners, who ran bioinformatics at Children's Hospital, to be running your company, because there's a language and an experience and a stakeholder mix behind the scenes that if you've not worked in that, you'll just never you'll never be able to crack that code on your own. So expertise just has to be focused on what is the pressure point of the opportunity at every stage. So the pressure point of the opportunity in a consumer startup might be, again, testing customer acquisition to make sure you're defining and positioning the product properly. That comes secondary to whether the technology is the biggest, better, is faster. So something like biomarker discovery, like the ability to access the data, understand the data, may be the pressure point. And that pressure point will move then. And so in 2 years, for either one of those types of companies, the pressure point of that company is different. And so the expertise required at each stage is going to be different. And you may not be the one that's there to scale the company later on, and that's okay too. So I think that the challenge is to focus on what is that pressure point. I mean, Brad Feld, famous foundry group investor, he's very famous in my mind for contemplating the idea that, like, if you're having to focus on more than one pressure point at a time, you're probably going to fail, because there's just too much risk early on and unknown to be able to solve for two things at once. And I think that's if I were giving advice to myself in earlier days, I'd say, what is the one thing that at this stage of the company would matter the most to get to the chance of surviving the next phase? And so I think that's really the question at hand. And unfortunately, I won't belabor this point, but I think that a lot of entrepreneurs and business schools coach the idea of building the late stage business from day zero. Mm-hmm. So you play house. Oh, we need a CFO, we need a CMO. You probably don't. You probably need somebody to help you solve this one problem, mm-hmm. whatever that problem is, whatever that pressure point is to get to the next milestone. So I look at it as like, but the challenge is identifying that problem. Like, what is that pressure point? Because it can feel like it's everything, but it probably is really one thing at one point in time. Mm-hmm. My instinct, but with no real evidence, is that reducing the friction to be a part of the system is critical for anyone to want to come in. And so while I would philosophically be interested in, you know, more economic development, but it's just like the purpose of economic development from the government's eyes doesn't map to the financial markets. They don't care about growing jobs. They care about growing companies, about creating shareholder value. And so I think any community that can reduce the friction of access to whatever the resources are, starting a company faster, filing your taxes better, literally all those things sound inconsequential, but they just make it harder to be an entrepreneur. None of those things add value to your business to do them. They are requirements to be in business. So the less friction to be in business, in my opinion, helps increase growth. Now, I think Elio and Jeremiah mentioned this. There's a story to be told for every community about what's really valuable in that community. I think we undersell Columbus a lot. That being said, it's a pretty unsexy sell. So what I tell people is, it's a really easy place to live. The economics are good. The people are pretty nice. There's access to things you need. You can get anywhere you want to go from here. I ever tell people there's about 2 million people in the region, they're like, no kidding. Didn't know that. It's understated that there is the awesome spectrum of intellectual, interesting people and down to earth, you know, rural farming, like get your shit kickers on and go do stuff, people here. That to me is the selling point of it. So yeah, summarize that. I just, you know, you can cut this out if you need to, buddy. But like, it's basically like, I just look at if Columbus becomes the market where it is the easiest to get to the resources. So I got lucky. My mom knew some people. She introduced me to some people. Like, but if I didn't have that connection, I'm not sure at that time if I would have found those resources. Being amazing ambassadors to outsiders to access whatever it is, the community, to me, is something like 614 Startups. I'll tell a quick story here. We were looking at Birmingham for a market expansion for a business we had. There's a company there called Shipt, S-H-I-P-T, to be clear. They were acquired by Target as their home delivery company. The founder of that company knew that it was going to be hard to attract talent to Birmingham, but he was determined to build the company in Birmingham. And because it was scaling so fast, he developed his own quasi-economic development group specifically for early stage founders driving interesting people. So what he did is called Birmingham Bound. And these people are unbelievable. I made the inquiry through a friend of a friend that got us interested in Birmingham. I got in touch with these people. They created a 48-hour docket for me with individual introductions to all of the CEOs of the startups, to the investors, to the city players, whoever it was. I was busy for 2 days, literally nonstop. And that wasn't a government-run thing. That was because they know the Deadpool model. we need more startups here, because if there's more startups here, some of them are going to go out of business. And then those people who were at the company like to work at startups. They're going to go work at other startups. It's the Silicon Valley model. It's not the capital there. It's the Deadpool model. We need more people that are that scar tissue. So I saw what they did and I was like, man, that just, they shortened the distance from me having to do all of the hard work of, okay, who's the five entrepreneurs I should meet to understand the market, to do all this. It was incredible. I think they've grown that organization. But anyways, access to resources, lower friction in being a business. To me, that's the skids that can be greased by the economic development, the cities to say like, we're open for business. And, you know, put an entrepreneur on staff for as an EIR whose job is just to introduce people moving to the city to other entrepreneurs. Like that in of itself will feel like the welcoming committee that everyone's like, wow, I got to know. And in Columbus, as we all know, once you know one person in a set area, you're going to know everybody, maybe more than you want to. So to me, it's like that should be a trait that we triple down on, that we own, that we never lose sight of, because to me, that's like one of my favorite things about this community.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Brian. We have to wrap the podcast at some point, so we're going to wrap it now. But we have another half hour or so. There's wings here. There's drinks here. Brian, you did a wonderful job. And thank you, everybody, for being here.
That's a wrap, folks. You can find this and all our episodes on our website, 614startups.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Anchor, and all your favorite podcasting platforms. Don't forget to subscribe and write a review. If you'd like updates sent directly to your inbox, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter on the website. To engage in the 614 Startups community, follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at 614 Startups on all platforms and join the conversation. For sponsorship opportunities and collaborations, email us at info@614startups.com.